This talk was part of Marxism 2010, A Planet to Save, A World to Win. The conference took place on May 28th through 30th at the Ryerson University Student Center. For more information, please visit www.marxismconference.ca.
Okay, we're going to get started so people can have a seat and get ready. Welcome to the session of Marxism. The session is called Feminism, Secularism, and Islam. My name is Kelly Holloway. I'm going to be chairing this session. And we have a really excellent panel of speakers. To my right is Hilary Massa, Benoit Renault, and Tadesse Arethkos. And each speaker will have about 15 minutes to talk about this subject, followed by a discussion from you. So without further ado, Hilary, you can get started.
Okay. Well, thank you everybody for coming. We're going to kind of touch upon the subject in very different ways. I'm going to talk about kind of from my own perspective as a Muslim woman, what it means to live in a secular society and kind of the arguments that get thrown at us as a Muslim community when particular laws and legislation are being passed specifically in faith context. So I'll start with a little bit of a personal anecdote, I guess, and then move into the rest of my talk. The topic of feminism, secularism, and Islam is a topic that I never really had to think about. To be a woman, to be a feminist, to be a Muslim woman who lives in a secular society has never seemed to me to be irreconcilable. I've grown up in a household where I was taught to question authority, challenge oppression when I saw it, to be an outspoken woman, to embrace my faith in the way that I felt it, or felt comfortable practicing it. I grew up learning to question everything, even religion and notions of God, and to never assume that all Muslims were the same. For me, to be a Muslim in a secularist Canada never meant that I had to reject my religion. Secularism, as I understood it, is the assertion that citizens have the right to be free from religious rule and teaching, and the right to freedom from governmental imposition of religion upon the people within the state that is neutral on matters of belief. So essentially the separation of church and state. I tell you this because these were the illusions I grew up with. Despite comments here and there from classmates and despite having to answer questions about my faith and about wearing hijab, it was only until I hit university that I started to question how much the proclamation of state secularism is more of the state, in this case Canada, defining who or what is considered the other in the state, as much as it is providing freedom for individuals to practice whichever religion they please. Muslim women and their bodies have been the center of public debate since 9/11, although many would argue that we, as Muslim women, have been orientalized long before the attack of the Twin Towers. Western scholarship and popular media have throughout history been obsessed and fascinated with the status of women in Islam. According to many scholars, early 19th century Orientalist travel literature portrayed Muslim women as sexually exotic others in harems and at the height of exploit and sex tourism. More recently, scholarly and popular mass media project images of Muslim women that include distorted stereotypes of oppressed, muted, veiled, or even shrouded women living in what is often described as misogynistic and violent religious culture. Unfortunately, Islam as a religion and the Muslim culture remain grossly misunderstood by the West, even amongst those who run in so-called progressive circles. Muslim women, as portrayed in today's society, are oppressed, covered, uneducated, silent, passive, and even and given as an excuse for why our governments wage war and assert their secularism. In a multicultural state like Canada, Islam and Muslims are only welcome if they exist within the parameters of what is deemed to be by the state to be reasonable. The moderate Muslim is the Muslim that hides her faith, is not critical of society around them, does not challenge state policies, and is just grateful that a country like Canada has allowed them to stay. From the U.S.-led occupation of Iraq, to the war on terror, to the ban of hijab in France, to Canada's invasion of Afghanistan, and to Quebec's recent move to pass legislation banning those who wear the face veil or niqab from accessing public service, we can see how in a post-9/11 world, our bodies, my body as a Muslim woman, has been used as an excuse to wage war, to bring democracy, to champion secularism, and to further women's rights. I would like to stop for a minute and examine the debate that is happening right now around Bill 94. And for those who don't know, this is legislation that is being proposed in Quebec to ban anyone wearing a face veil or a niqab from accessing essential public services. And according to the Montreal Gazette, Bill 94 was introduced in the Quebec National Assembly would require both public servants dispensing government services and citizens receiving those services to have their face uncovered. This does not just mean being able to get your driving license or get a health card. It also means accessing any publicly funded service, so schools, doctors, childcare facilities, and the justice system, etc. The bill is said to be a response to the demands within Quebec to establish guidelines on wearing religious clothing in the public sector. And it would affirm guarantees in Quebec's Human Rights Charter of the equality of women and men and the religious neutrality of the state. The bill itself is being touted as a move towards women's equality, but more prominent are the arguments around secularism, integration, and Quebec values. In the word of Yolande James, which is Quebec's Minister of Immigration, if you want to integrate into Quebec society, here are our values. We want to see your face. Further, Premier of Quebec Jean Charest states that the bill reflects his government's commitment to open secularism. He said, noting that other religious symbols such as the Christian crucifix, Jewish skull cap, or Muslim headscarf can continue to be worn by those providing and receiving government services. The niqab and the burqa are considered, in his opinion, unacceptable in part because they interfere with security, identification, and communication. So I want to juxtapose this with comments made by the author of the controversial Life Code that came out of Pierreville, Quebec, Andre Drouin, who states that Canada's multicultural policy is idiocy and calls for the moratorium on immigration. He also cast doubt on the separation of church and state, noting that Canadian Charter of Rights and Freedom starts off affirming the supremacy of God. As crazy as this man is, I can't help but be relieved by his honesty. In a country whose constitution begins, whereas Canada is founded upon principles that recognize the supremacy of God, and in a country that has a national anthem that prays, God keep our land glorious and free, the values that underlie Canada's values originate from religion. And this attack on Islam in Canada and around the world is not about declaring secularism or even about championing women's rights. Legislation like Bill 94 actually work to exclude and further marginalize women from accessing services that is rightfully theirs to access. This attack is very much linked to current-day anti-immigrant sentiment. It's related to creating an us-versus-them mentality and ultimately about creating false notions of what Canadian identity actually is. As Sana Owen stated in a recent article she published in Rabble about Bill 94, she says, the rationalizations given for Bill 94 have broad consequences for Canadian women today. This bill strengthens the already choking grip of the state over public funds and facilities. It restricts who may and may not have access to universal medical care and education, services guaranteed to Canadian citizens through the Health Care Act and both Quebec and Canadian Charter of Rights. The bill also permits state officials in Quebec to declare in what manner citizens may deliver and receive state services or what faith they may put forward when interacting with or on behalf of the state. And although I'm using Bill 94 in Quebec to highlight my point, I don't want people to leave thinking that the rest of Canada is any better. Jason Kenney, Canada's immigration minister, recently put out a new citizenship guide where he states, in Canada, men and women are equal under the law. The document says, Canada's openness and generosity do not extend to barbaric cultural practices that tolerate spousal abuse, honor killings, female genital mutilation, or other gender-based violence. This isn't in the actual document that is given to newcomers to Canada. Those guilty of these crimes are severely punished under Canada's criminal laws. He argues that this was included so that new citizens are clear what Canadian values are and what is culturally acceptable here. So I guess that's basically the gist of my presentation, and I hope that we can have further discussion about this. But I'd like to end by saying that Canada was built on the backs of immigrants, and I'm not an unapologetic Muslim, nor am I a moderate Muslim. I'm a Muslim woman that believes that in Canada, the values that should connect us are those of equity and access. The concept of secularism and feminism exist in my world as concepts that allow women to stand up for the rights and minority groups to live without fear. And the debate around hijab and around the niqab around how Islam should or should not be practiced has existed for a long time within the Muslim community. In fact, it still exists today. However, as a Muslim woman living in a state that is constantly pushing back against the rights of immigrants while faking its commitment to multiculturalism and women's rights, I'm too busy fighting to exist and defend my beliefs to justify and justify myself and how I can stand for what I stand for, that I'm not able to actually engage in these types of discussions. Secularism has nothing to do with this. Feminism has absolutely nothing to do with this. This is about justifying foreign policies and our war on terror and maintaining very racist notions of what it means to be Canadian. Thank you.
Is it my turn?
Yes.
So, first, maybe I should do some kind of a disclaimer or situate myself in the debate, because I'm not coming out of this from a theoretical or, intellectual perspective, but from my own practice. I've been involved in the Quebec left, as long as, even before I was an adult. And for the past 2 years, I was the general secretary, well, technically still for another week, of Quebec Solidaire, which is the biggest political organization that the left in Quebec has managed to put together so far, which is a great achievement in itself. And that whole debate about what secularism is supposed to mean and about wearing religious, wearing accessories or pieces of clothing that may have a religious connotation or origin, has been a debate inside my own party and among more broadly people on the left in Quebec for the past few years around the reasonable accommodation, so-called crisis in 2007-2008, the Bouchard-Taylor Commission, and then more recently the program debates inside Quebec Solidaire that led to a convention last November. And all through that issue of Islamophobia, I've been taking it really personal, as we say. I don't have any Muslim roots, or I'm not, myself subjected to Islamophobia, but having been an anti-war activist since 2001 and beyond that, it's very troubling to me and actually painful to see that some people on the left, some people who should be with me, are taking the wrong position on those questions. It's hard. I wouldn't be affected, if people on the right, if people in the government say nasty things, I'm not surprised. I can be just shocked in general and be outraged. But it doesn't hurt as much as when people on the left say the same thing or are unable to respond to this type of discourse as they should. And so what I'm going to try to come up with over the next few minutes is the initial results of my own personal investigation as to why that is, I titled my own notes, "Why Are Sections of the Left Influenced by Islamophobia?" Where the hell does that come from? How does it work? Why would people, for example, just to give you a very symbolic example of that, at that Quebec Solidaire convention last November, we passed a resolution in support of the BDS campaign on Palestine. Not only did we pass that resolution, but when the chair in front of the room asked if there were any objections, you could have heard a fly, in the room, even though we were more than 200 people in that room. There was no opposition whatsoever to the BDS campaign. But when it came to debating whether people who work in the public sector in Quebec should be allowed to wear any kind of religious insignia or pieces of clothing, or a good third of the convention voted in favor of the position to ban any kind of religious symbol, that's what it's being called, from the public service, like a third. Those same people, a few hours earlier, were in complete solidarity with the Palestinian struggle against Israel and all of that. Like, I'm not talking about people like Tony Blair or, you know, the leaders of the Socialist Party in France. I'm talking about people who are internationalists at the core, who are completely outraged if you tell them that their position is racist or discriminatory in any way. You know, they just don't see it. So where does that blank spot, you know, or how do you call that when you're driving and you can't see the person driving? The blind spot, yeah. Where does that blind spot come from? And that's what I came up with a few ideas about that through the debate that has been going on inside Quebec Solidaire and on the margins of it, and also in France with the new anti-capitalist party, MPA, which is a very radical party. But inside that party, there are people who are hostile to the very notion of having a hijab-wearing woman as a candidate in the French regional elections just a few months ago. So a first hypothesis, you know, when you have been trying to uproot that discourse and figure out where it comes from, I think it comes in part from the Stalinist version of international solidarity. And what I mean by that is that, thank you. It took me 5 minutes to do my intro as usual. Now I have to get into it in 10 minutes for the rest. What I mean by the Stalinist tradition of international solidarity is that that internationalism was in fact based on the interests of the USSR. It was based on national interests and sometimes China, once they split between China and Russia. So when they were supporting a national liberation struggle or a struggle somewhere in the world, it was because it suited their interests. It wasn't true internationalism. It was conditional support. They would support a liberation struggle, a national struggle, an anti-imperialist struggle, if it suited them, if they thought it was good for their own interests. And it would also be completely acritical. Once they decided to support a struggle, if anyone dared to criticize that particular anti-imperialist movement in any way for their politics or their tactics or anything else, they would hammer at you with everything they got and call you a traitor to the cause, and you know, you're trying to undermine the struggle and rah rah rah, you know. So it was conditional but acritical. True internationalism should be the reverse of that. It should be unconditional but critical. If a struggle is against imperialism, we support it because we're against imperialism, because imperialism is not in our interest as workers in an imperialist country. But we can be critical. We can have a dialogue. We can say, well, you know, if it's between Hezbollah and Israel, we hope Hezbollah wins. Doesn't mean that we approve everything Hezbollah has ever done or said, or, you know, everything about their politics, or that we would tell people, you know, read books from Hezbollah, that's the best politics we've ever seen. You know, we can have a criticism of those politics, but at the same time, be very clear that we don't take the side of Israel, or we don't stay neutral if there's a fight between, you know, NATO and armed resistance in Afghanistan. You know, no matter what form it takes, NATO is imperialism. It's basically all of imperialism put together in NATO. We want them to lose. We want them to get the hell out of Afghanistan, because we know from experience and from history that imperialism destroys everything it touches. It's the opposite of the Midas touch, you know. Midas turned everything he touched into gold. Imperialism turns everything it touches into shit, you know. That's, we're always against imperialism. So that translates, I would say, into part of the discourse that some people on the left have towards the Muslim world and Muslim people in general. It's the idea that, yeah, okay, Hezbollah may be a resistance movement, but they're Islamists, you know, they're not socialists, you know. They're not like us, they don't think like us. And then the solidarity becomes conditional. It's not only critical, it becomes conditional. It's like, But, you know, in the debates around Afghanistan, people would say, yeah, but what if NATO leaves? You know, the Taliban will take over, and what's going to happen then? And people are distrustful of national liberation movements that are not explicitly socialist, even though a lot of those who were explicitly socialist were not socialist at all. You know, think about the Khmer Rouge in Cambodia, for example. They were supported uncritically by a whole lot of people on the left until they started, you know, committing self-genocide, you know, which is something that they invented. So I think there's something of that nature when you have that, what I would call asymmetrical feminist internationalism, which is that we support the struggle of women as long as what they, as long as what they fight is something that we approve. If they fight for the right to remove veils or headscarves or whatever else, then go, we support them wholeheartedly. But if in the West a woman says, I want to have the right to wear one, then they don't support that struggle. You know, so it's a conditional feminism. You know, we're going to support the right of women to do whatever they want as long as they want what we want them to want. And I think that's rooted in that kind of tradition and in something of a colonialist view, you know, that somehow Western societies are more enlightened and we should help those poor people free themselves from their bad ideas and, you know, backward traditions. And there's still something of that. The other part, the other root that I think it goes even deeper than the Stalinist tradition is what we could call the, it's my 5 minute thing, okay. It's the radical Republican tradition that goes back to the French Revolution. Basically, it goes back to the very origin of the notion of the left. Because people might or might not know that the idea of the left and the right comes from the French Revolution. They were sitting in a big room in an empty theater in a circle, and those on the left of the president were the radicals and those on the right were the conservatives. And that's where the term left comes from. Those people on the left in the French Revolution ended up in a war, in a war internationally against international intervention to try to crush the French Revolution, but also in a civil war against uprisings in parts of the country. And in both cases, and in particular in the Civil War aspect of it, religion was a big factor. The Catholic Church overwhelmingly was against the revolution and fueling the reactionary, the counter-revolutionary movement to bring back the king and reverse the revolution. And so that bourgeois democratic revolutionary movement in France and across Europe that built throughout the 19th century developed a very strong anti-Catholic and sometimes just anti-clerical in the sense of being against religion in general. It developed a big component of anti-religion, the idea that, and some philosophical notions that somehow religious ideas were inherently anti-democratic or reactionary, or and that we had to fight against those ideas in order to win democratic rights and equality for all and all of that. And this is what I believe has led to the French version or interpretation of what we refer to as secularism. It was, in fact, for example, the law that's been referred to a lot in the debate that was passed in 1905 for secularism in France was the end result of a very long struggle of a section of the French ruling class against another section of the French ruling class, really. It was the secular industrial bourgeoisie against the traditional old semi-feudal ruling classes, the nobility and the clergy and so on. And the goal of French secularism and the kind of social reforms in general that were passed at the beginning of the 20th century were to create in France a mass of of workers and of potential soldiers, you know, to defend the French state, to be at the service of the French ruling class and the French state, and, you know, wonderful things like World War One and colonialism, you know. That's what the secular French, the secular public French school system was made for, to make good soldiers and good workers and good wives for those soldiers and workers. And I read in a document from the debate inside the new anti-capitalist party in France that actually those same politicians that brought about those secularism laws in the early 20th century were also encouraging and supporting missionaries going to the colonies to bring Christianity to other countries. You know, they were excluding the Catholic Church from the school system in France, but they didn't mind if there was Catholic education going on in Africa or in Southeast Asia or anywhere else. They still thought, you know, Catholicism was better than anything that was going on in the colonies. Together with that, I would say, Jacobin tradition, you know, from the French Revolution, you have that notion that the state should free the people from themselves, you know, that you have to use the state and repression in order to fight against old ideas and against old mentalities. And so it's very deep, that notion that you can't just trust people to liberate themselves, you know, or to just decide for themselves what they want to do with their life. You know, it's an authoritarian tradition, and it goes together with something that in the IS tradition we refer to as socialism from above, you know, that somehow the authority of the state is the tool we need to change society and make the world better and gain all the things that, you know, all the things that we want on the left more broadly. And we oppose to that socialism from below. And I think what we have now in parts of the left is a feminism from above. You know, it's borrowing from that tradition of socialism from above and applying it to feminism, saying we're going to force women to correspond to that notion that we have of what it is to be free or what it is to be emancipated. And somehow that's normal. I didn't even have time to talk about what's specific to Quebec in that whole thing in a very, very, very short way. In Quebec, apart from those two things I just explained, in Quebec you have the added layer of the fact that the Catholic Church was dominating Quebec society up to the 1960s. Myself, you know, I'm not that old. I'm older than I look, apparently. But when I was in high school, there was a priest, the official high school priest. That was in the early 80s. And most people had Catholic dogma taught in the high school as part of the normal curriculum. You had to ask for an exception to take, ethical, the secular ethics kind of class, you know, which I did, and that it's in those classes that I learned the most about religion from a Catholic. Anyway, there were a lot of contradictions in the Quebec school system all the way to the 80s, and so for a lot of people in Quebec, there's a general hostility to religion that is easily triggered by Islamophobic argument. You know, it doesn't, they're planting that seed of Islamophobia in very fertile ground for a lot of people who have had to fight against their own religion to gain democratic rights, to gain women's rights, you know, women's legal equality, the right to choose, and all of those other things. Those democratic and feminist struggles throughout the 60s and 70s and even before that had to be waged against the Catholic Church. And a lot of people just get triggered, you know, by that kind of discourse, and they're distrustful of religion in general for that specific reason. I'm just going to have to wait until my wrap-up to talk about what we should do. We'll leave it at that for now.
I completely agree with the perspective offered by Guillory and Benoit, and yet I will be giving a different angle to think about questions around Islam and feminism and Islam versus secularism. I will first say a few things about what's happening in Quebec, or just some comments on the nature of the debate and the wrongheadedness of the debate, and then I will talk more generally about pitting of Islam versus secularism internationally by imperialist forces. On the issue of Quebec, I would say that the issue is really not one of Islam versus feminism or Islam versus secularism. As Benoit has said, Quebec is not a secular society after all. I mean, France may claim some kind of identity as a wrong-headed or slanted secular nation. It does have a history of radical secularism, but Quebec hasn't had that history, and it doesn't have that at the present. And even the radical secularism that people claim as part of French identity is one that is actually very slanted towards a Catholic Christianity and so on, and it is never fully secular after all. So we also need to disassociate some automatic assumptions made in these so-called debates about the inherent contradiction between Islam and feminism on the one hand, and an inherent affinity between secularism and feminism on the other hand. I think we need to question all those embedded and implicit assumptions in this wrong-headed and misled kind of debate that's going on in Quebec. The issue is not these things between a contradiction between Islam and feminism or a major contradiction between Islam versus secularism. But the issue in Quebec is really one of equal and inclusive citizenship. It's an issue of justice, equality, and human dignity. And those are the things that are being trampled in this so-called debate. And that's something that people who define themselves in the left that need to be genuinely concerned about. Those people who are indeed sincerely concerned about women's conditions and women's rights need to understand that a politics, a debate on niqab or other issues of dress, if framed in these terms, would have major contradictions and major shortcomings, none of which those sincere concerned parties from the left would want to identify with. First, the shortcomings and the contradictions are, first of all, that it hurts women, first and foremost, who become the target, whose bodies become the ground on which these wars get fought. Secondly, it hurts Muslims in general. It makes Muslims in general feel excluded and rejected by the larger society. It makes some Muslims so defensive in response to these kinds of debates and in response to being targeted by mainstream forces, that it actually has a conservatizing rather than liberating effect on Muslims. And finally, in terms of the general politics of these things, it leads to a diversion from real feminist and other struggles for justice, equality, dignity, and democracy. So if there are people in the left who are generally concerned about Muslim women, Muslim immigrant women's rights and conditions, they better wage struggles in support of labor rights, labor conditions, employment issues, settlements and social services and so on, rather than fight these battles on over the bodies of women. Now, having said this about what is happening in Quebec, I would like to open up the discussion about secularism versus Islam and the relationship of these issues, how they are framed in relation to imperialism worldwide. As we think about Islamophobia and the place of Islamophobia internationally at the moment, I think it is important to not see Islamophobia in monolithic or simplistic terms. We should not underestimate the resilience and flexibility of imperialist strategists in terms of what they can utilize to fight wars internationally, to reject the right of people for self-determination and so on. In terms of imperial strategy and racism that support empire and war, in my opinion, it's perfectly compatible to have simultaneous Islamophobia on the one hand, and what we can call Islamophilia for those defined as the good Muslims on the other hand. And I think that these two strategies or these two approaches are very much adopted and used by imperial strategists simultaneously at the moment. And this should not necessarily be seen as a contradiction or a weakness in imperial strategy. In my opinion, it's actually something that strengthens imperial strategy altogether, and for a number of different reasons. First of all, in terms of appealing to Western public to get their support for imperial wars, it actually appeals to have Islamophobia and Islamophilia of some sort at the same time, appeals to conservative political taste as well as liberal and leftist political taste all at once. You can have the conservatives defend a universal Islamophobic line at the same time as having some liberals define who the good Muslims are, separate them from the bad Muslims and so on, and pit them against one another. In terms of how this imperial strategy affects Muslims, I think it also is also more effective in the sense that it keeps Muslims on their toes. It makes them more anxious, more obedient sometimes, so that some Muslims can try to fit to the image of the good Muslim as defined by imperial strategists. And it keeps them more disciplined and ready and willing to police and discipline one another. So I think it makes perfect sense to have these two seemingly contradictory, but not necessarily so contradictory strategies going on simultaneously. And I would like to argue that as imperial forces have used Islam historically at certain conjunctions, for example, during the Cold War, they may also be very willing and very much interested in using Islam or certain forms of moderate Islam at the present, very much for to advance capitalism, global capitalism, and advance imperialism around the world at the same time. So we need to remember, I mean, some rather recent history of how certain Islamic forces have been used by the United States to fight against secular third world nationalism. So when we look at the Tariqat-e-Islam used against Sukarno in Indonesia, and helping support the butchery of close to a million people. We need to be very aware of that history. When we look at the support for Jemaat-e Islam against Zulfikar Ali Bhutto in Pakistan, that's another example. The support for Muslim Brothers at some point in time against the Nasser regime, his pan-Arabism and secular nationalism, that's another example. And the Israel support in the initial beginnings of Hamas against the PLO at some point. I mean, who's supported against them has shifted over time, but historically we need to be very aware of that history of which forces have been used against whom and for what reasons. So we need to, therefore, what I'm saying is that we need to be very aware of how flexible, how resilient imperialist forces can be. Now, we need to remember that moderate Islam in the imperialist context is not defined really in terms of the interpretation made of Islam by the Muslims themselves, but it is rather a term that's used to basically distinguish the good Muslims defined by their friendliness toward market capitalism and toward U.S. imperialism from the bad Muslims who may be against these things. In foreign policy circles, it seems like there are new attempts to define and differentiate good Muslims from bad Muslims. I'll just mention, I haven't done enough research on this to find other names and other titles, but I'll just mention one author specifically who has been publishing some interesting books, one after the other, who is now an advisor to Obama. Vali Nasser, an Iranian-born author and now an advisor to Obama, published a book called Forces of Fortune, The Rise of the New Muslim Middle Class and What It Will Mean for Our World. Our World. Published in 2009, and very soon after that, a book which is probably repeating the same arguments, which I have not seen yet, that he has published just this past month, called Mechanomics, The March of the New Muslim Middle Class. So in these books, Vali Nasser, among others, is defining a type of Islam or an approach to Muslims that can encourage those forces or those constituencies in Muslim countries that are very friendly to a market capitalist regime and also friendly to the United States. So Nasser is arguing that there's nothing to fear about Islam in general as long as we can distinguish between the good ones and the bad ones and support the good ones against the others. And not just support the good ones, but also support the good ones to fight against the bad ones. I'm originally from Turkey, and I'm very conscious of the fact that what is happening in relation to Turkey is that on the one hand, and there is an Islamist party in power in Turkey at the present. The approach to this party by the West has been cautious on the one hand and cautiously optimistic on the other hand, thinking that this party or this kind of a political force can after all be used much better than Western military forces to go and support wars, let's say, in Afghanistan. And even though Turkey has refused to send military forces to Afghanistan, still, has sent military forces, but now it wants to maintain only some police forces, the U.S. And other Western powers actually see this as a much better kind of force there than any kind of Western force that could be represented in those places. And what's also interesting is how these new foreign policy strategists are now interpreting secularism, for example, in Turkey. They have actually a very negative view of what secularism in Turkey has meant. And it's true that secularism in the Turkish context, like in Quebec or in France, has had this radical edge and has been extremely repressive of Islam and often sometimes quite intolerant of Islam. I mean, the debate in France or in Quebec around headscarves have been very much present in Turkey, and Turkey is still a country where, despite having an Islamist party in power, where young women are still banned from certain public spaces, public offices, and universities, as long as they wear the headscarf. Nevertheless, I share all these critiques of radical secular Kemalism in this regard, but these are not the only reasons why people such as Vali Nasir, who are advising Obama, are against Kemalism. They have more of a problem with Kemalism also being associated historically with a more radical nationalism on the one hand, and statist policy on the other hand, statism as opposed to market capitalism. And at the present, the fact that many Kemalists have become rather staunch nationalists, for good or and bad, also means that in foreign policy circles, they are defined as more suspicious than some of the moderate Muslims and so on. So what I'm trying to say here is that we need to be very aware of how neither Islam nor secularism is the enemy, that some of these divisions and some of these definitions pitting people against one another can be very wrong and very dangerous. And we need to be aware of the fact that a new Orientalism that tries to define the essence of Muslim majority societies as moderate Islamic may be as dangerous as strategies that try to impose some kind of secularism on these societies. A universal Islamophobia or partial Islamophilia, whether they are supportive of secularists or Islamists, can be very dangerous for people's right to define what is good for themselves, their rights and their struggle to define a life that's shaped after principles of equality, justice, dignity, and inclusion. So I just wanted to put a footnote to warn that there's much more complexity to the issues around Islamism versus secularism than they might appear to be in the Canadian context. Thank you.
Thank you very much to the panel. We now have an opportunity for discussion, so for about half an hour, panelists did have a rest, and you can make a comment and contribute to the discussion or ask a question. Please put up your hand and I'll take a speaker so that everyone is able to make their contribution.
I'm whether the panel had any material on sort of why now, looking at Quebec and looking at France in the world, sort of the possibility of the work that you've come to with. Like a generation ago, nobody would have been interested, and then on the whole, it was more sort of a husband or a father deciding. Now it's sort of young women are deciding, I want to do that, it's not being imposed. So why wouldn't we set up that a generation ago where it may have been a free decision? Now it seems a lot of people are deciding freely. I suppose like my suggestion would be if we had a sort of ethnocentricity, you know, and they expect everyone to grow up and be like us. I don't know. I just wonder why now, if it ethnocentricity, if it's the difficult socio-economic context, people more insecure and secure, and it's a useful target to achieve both.
Just so you know, for the rest of the questions, the panelists will come back at the end and answer, but others in the group can answer questions that are posed.
Basically, that's actually the question. When that debate came up in Quebec, I'm like, this is exactly from a debate that just happened right now. Is it opportunism or what happened? So outside of the debate, the education, the, you know, the theory, the leftist theory, it just seemed too opportunistic. I'm just taking it from a person. All of a sudden we're having this debate. So from that, I wrote a note from the first person I'm going to try to interpret it. I said, I wondered if this was just creating, or they're finding ways, useful ways to create cultural spaces, versus we're not all together defining oppression anymore. We think we already know what oppression is, or what it looks like. And so either we feel comfortable in that context, or is it really we're fighting to create cultural space? Like, I know that's huge, I can't even define it for myself, but I wonder if that is like opportunism, that we don't know how, you know, to divide everybody in the world would make it easier for any particular side to kind of fight a particular, you know, a particular ideology or method. So I think if we go back to define what oppression is now, I think people will have the tools, perhaps, to really look at the debate again. I don't know, I think that's where it comes from, because at the end of the day, to me, it was opportunistic. It's like they're doing it because France did it. So if that is a whole part, if it can work, it can get into our system, I think then maybe as a society, or maybe the concept of democracy and all those troubles is we haven't addressed certain things that we want to from the point of the leftist versus any other ideology. So I wonder if either the panelists or anybody had an idea that this is really just trying to create enclave in society to protect people because the system altogether either doesn't know what oppression is anymore or really doesn't know how oppression is being conveyed to.
Yeah, and I think, in terms of what's the role of Islamophobia for Western countries, I think we also have to look at how it can be used, apart from a sort of debate about religion, but how ruling classes actually use it to divide the people, and how it's actually in their interest to do that. Because if you look at both France and Quebec, if you look at when the debate really surfaced in France, what had been the backdrop, there were a whole series of quite militant strikes in the public sector, particularly among teachers in France, with a right-wing government that actually wanted to bring in serious cuts to the public sector. And so what did this whole debate, what role did it play? It actually served to divide workers at the time who were fighting back, because the French teachers, you know, got into this argument about whether young 13-year-old girls should be able to come to school wearing a hijab, and ended up supporting the state, you know, that brought in the legislation. And it actually served to divide the movement. And if you look at Quebec right now, Jean Charest is facing the possibility of huge public sector strikes. And And what role is it playing in Quebec? I mean, obviously we have to oppose it because it is racism, because it's actually against the rights of women to make choices, as Hillary, you know, pointed out. But it's also a tool that the ruling class uses to divide and conquer. And so we really have to be cognizant of that, that we support the rights of Muslim women and Muslims in general, but that also it's undermining everyone's rights. I mean, that's what the government is trying to do with that. So we really have to be aware of that as well, I think.
Yeah, I agree. I think these are good questions because we do have to think about how it's operating on two levels at once. The panel is right, they talked very much about the war on terror, the fundamental thing that's going on. But when you look at what governments around the world and in the West are faced with right now in terms of dealing with their own populations, on the one hand, trying to continue to build consent for this war without end, at the same time, a massive economic crisis is taking place and the amount of money that's being spent on the war versus the inability to do anything about the economy. So that is a dual problem that governments have. And they have to find ways to combine their scapegoating techniques so that they address both. And the racist argument is not new, but it does have this, because of the dimension of religion and the way it can prey on the notions of liberal thinking, it's been used in that particular way, both around the war and around the economy. But, you know, we can think of some examples that haven't even necessarily appealed to women's rights to do that. And one of the worst was the debate in Switzerland over the ban on women's rights. That's another open forum that Islamophobia can take, simply to say the presence of Muslims in the West is itself a threat, right? And that's sort of the extreme. But it is connected to a more generalized way that scapegoating with immigrants is used as a distraction. And so in Quebec today, along the lines of what was mentioned about the way that job debating presence is used on the teachers' unions, there is a massive attack in the public sector. Massive. And the threat of a real possibility of a fight this fall with there's a big common trust table with all the public sector unions in bargaining, the possibility of a massive strike. Well, it's not surprising that this is the moment when a debate is being stirred up over a small, small number of women who are in crowds in Quebec as a distraction. And I think that's a very important part of why it's happening now.
One of the things that I think is important for us to talk about is how the debate is framed in English Canada versus in Quebec. And I think that component is important for progressives here because there's sometimes this sort of unspoken or casual anti-Quebec chauvinism that's expressed in English Canada, where it's like Quebec is so racist and it's like so typical, and it allows us to ignore the exact same phenomena that are underway here, but to me doesn't portray it in the same kind of way. And I think what's important about the discussion in Quebec is to, as a number of speakers have mentioned, is to look at the particular historical context, the struggle against the hegemony and the dominance of the Catholic Church in the 1960s and 70s, why there was, the Quiet Revolution, why there is a particular appeal to secularism and feminist values, and how that is used to disguise the fact that Quebec as Catholic is not at all secular. Or the same is true in English Canada. And I think about there was a debate in English Canada about the use of faith-based arbitration. And it was this massive debate where Sharia law is coming to Ontario and it's going to be Saudi-style punishment, right? At a police car, right? It was just really accusations and reactionary. A year later, there was this debate about the recitation of the Lord's Prayer, which apparently happens every single day in Queen's Park, right? We nobody had a big debate about how secularism is under threat because of that. And the crucifix that appears in the National Assembly, we fund the public dollars, we have the school board in Ontario. There are all these, not just residual remnants of religion in public life, they're all over the place. So a lot of times I think when people invoke secularism or feminism or whatever, it's an attempt to provide some kind of progressive cover for what are essentially reactionary ideals. It reminds me of, I'm really interested in the idea of how sort of a partial Islamophilia is the sort of other side of the coin of Islamophobia. And I think it's similar to the idea that ruling classes want to appeal both to conservative audiences to pass this legislation, but it also appeals to progressive audiences. Like, the National Post has discovered gay rights recently, and it's discussion around right? All of a sudden, talking about it picks up these issues, right? And most of the time, what I have to say on those topics are incredibly offensive and homophobic. But you can tell that they're appealing to a particular audience to advance what's an incredibly reactionary agenda. Last thing I want to say is that on the threshold, the homophilia and homophobia, how many strikes you can switch, right? You can go from one to the other. And it reminds me of, there's a very well-known speaker that people probably know, Sarah Crossley, who's identified as sort of the spokesperson of the Muslim community in Canada. He publishes regularly in the National Post. And I almost always disagree with what he has to say in describing what he thinks is representative of the Muslim community, but recently he challenged Jordan editorial that took on a Zionist speaker who said these really racist things about Muslims, and I thought it was a very mild critique. But what was so alarming about it is that the very same people who hold him up on the same pedestal that he is the voice of Islam, how quickly they pull that pedestal out and said, look, this is what all Muslims are like, they're all right, they all have a different gender, it doesn't matter. It's like, I could not believe, I felt sorry for what his experience was because he has given this perspective, but as soon as there was like this small critique, it was this incredibly racist attack on him that was just incredibly Islamophobic. So I think that analysis is really important to see how the only guiding principle for this is about the interest of imperialism and neoliberalism. It's not about religion or secularism or feminism or freedom. It's about advancing those interests and trying to figure out which vehicle will best do it.
Yeah, I apologize for coming in late. I think it's the first part of the presentation, but I blame that on the relationship crisis. Followed up from the last couple of comments, and that us situating this in the shifting needs of imperialism is really important. As I'm listening to the discussion, listening to the presentation, I'm remembering that the key social movement of our century is the anti-war movement. Without that, any questions, I see the key social movement. And the key place for that in Canada with respect. There was 2 magnificent, 250,000 strong embassies in 2003, which is the reason the Trump has entered the war. And in the context of that massive social movement, it creates defeat, it creates the defect and resistance to the cuts that are coming down, and it creates a tremendous and new unity between communities that hadn't contacted each other before. In particular, with the Islamic communities in Toronto and Montreal and elsewhere. The height of the social movement means to find the need for their backlash, their attack. They need to define this. They need to divide it. Now, one of the reasons I know this is not a particularly good reason because of Facebook. I have had 2 young children, cousins, their children, because most of the people we send to war are children, 18 and 19, having been a parent. I'm thinking of my 18 and 19 year olds going to war. They were in Afghanistan, and I've got my Facebook page, Facebook friends, so I got a cousin over in Afghanistan. And I put up on Facebook, you can hide people. I had to hide what they were saying. Because for them, being over there at war, they have to justify their war almost like it's almost like reading Peter Kipling's memoir. Sometimes it's weird to symbolize bringing good things from Afghanistan, and sometimes it's just racist. The 2 things going by the side. That racism needs to be fostered by the Canadian state and the United States government in order to prosecute their war. They need it. Without it, they can't prosecute the war. If the soldiers don't believe they're bringing civilization, then the soldiers will fight them. And I think that context shapes so much of what we're talking about here. Anyway, so thank you for the presentation.
I also apologize I'm late. I'm sorry I'm just calling on topic for the I think something that really interests me is first of all, the portrayal of a secular and a country like Canada is all based on a lot based on Christianity, Christian values as these normality in Canadian society as though uncontested sort of like that the biblical base of a lot of our laws and our society is just like the norm, and then everything else is positive, like contrary to that norm, even if it resonates with increasing number of Canadians or other countries. people in my background are finding more related to some liberation building movements, like in Latin America, that's sort of exploding for a long several years. And there are huge currents, like, from below, they come up, like liberation theology from Catholic communities where they saw people who were living basically with feudal slave-like conditions and had no rights, and were speaking out to their people. And they're doing it in a theological context, because that's what the priests were doing, right? That's why they were in the community in the first place. And then you have these other ones that came in, of more like often evangelical right-wing movements in the United States, that they really co-opted a lot of things, and people started leaving to evangelical communities and they get killed if they were in Catholic, like left-wing groups, right? And what I'm interested in is like people like Mark Ellis, who applied this kind of liberation theology background to Israel and Palestine and trying to reclaim Judaism as a force of justice and of social justice. Because he basically co-opted by a very liberating kind of Jewish style interpretation in North America, especially, and for the world, like the interpretation of Judaism and the American mind years ago. So I'm kind of interested in the Muslim context. If you guys have any insights into like maybe people to read for, I obviously it would be called the liberation theology in other movements, but I'm kind of interested to hear more about what's happening within you know, current for like deep social justice and I don't know, like genuine like alternative to capitalism within like different spaces of people.
My question, or it's not a question, it's more of a comment about feminism or feminism in today's current state or whatnot. I find it very interesting that when we talk about the certain implications that, in this case, let's say, in Islam, a woman and a hijab, or in certain, let's say, Sikh faith with the ceremonial dagger, or in a social company that men, Jewish men, put on their heads. And how we have those associations that really define, well, I'm a Jew, hence I have this, I'm a Christian, I wear the cross. And I find it interesting that we all have this attachment that really wants us to kind of divide ourselves, and yet we're having a conversation about, well, how do we bring this all down? When it really, you know, you want to be respectful about a religion, yet you kind of almost need to have a sort of local association to yourself to say, this is who I am. But respecting for it. However, I think the big thing that I often find is that then we kind of lose track of the sight of how is it a human, is a dignity then still being respected? Because, or are we just wishing to kind of associate ourselves with a specific icon or specific image versus really looking at the core of it? How is a woman then treated in Islam? Is she indeed free, or does the veil really kind of signify as a woman what I'm choosing and hence I'm free? Or can we actually go a little deeper and say, in that specific culture, is the woman then being treated as an equal? Or you associate yourself with that specific image? Like kind of set you free. And I always had an issue of trying to read up with myself if that is indeed the case or not. And it's not just for Islam, but I think it's in any other different type of religion that we need to look at more than just it's secularism really just because I want to have the right to practice the way it looks, the way that I carry a dagger or a cross. Or is it just, I mean, I think it ought to be just more than a talk about how we associate ourselves with our religion. And is that the thing? I mean, looking at churches, it's a huge thing where, you know, they insist on being secular by simply not, you know, forcing women not to wear the scarf. Yet, it's that, what, I'm going to say 90%, correct me if I'm wrong, but I don't know what percentage of the population is Muslim. Does that actually make it a secular country? I think so. So I think it's got to kind of go more than how we associate ourselves with that religion and look at the core of how are we as a person being treated and what are our real rights. And I think it has to go beyond then, you know, the associations with certain image.
I would like to say something I'm from Britain about really what's happening in Europe and above. So I find it most interesting what you've all been saying. I think that what is incredible is the sheer spectrum of opinion that have agreed that, you know, Islam is a problem. You know, as Stephen said, all the way from left-wing, feminists, and all the rest of it, talking about it in terms of, you know, claiming, you know, that women aren't free and women's wearing hijab, right through to the far-right of fascism. You know, and in Britain, there is a growing movement, a new organisation called the English Ascendancy, which mobilises thousands on the streets, including today, they had 800 in Newcastle, a small town in North East, on the basis of xenophobia and anti-migrant racism. That's it. They are occupied, they have a sense of being mosque, you know, and it's all about the idea that Muslims shouldn't be here, Muslims should integrate, Muslims should accept our great culture and all that stuff. I think that's something that when you look at how the ideas have developed really and how they've got, you know, I quite agree about the role of the war of terror and imperialism. We have to be totally reliant on the good war against the example of people giving them liberation, you know, we have to follow that. But actually, you know, it is something that I think it's not about culture, it is about pure racism, and I think that's something we have to keep coming back to. Because actually, you know, 10 years ago in Britain, people didn't talk about Muslims, they talked about Asians, yeah, blacks and Asians. Now it's differentiated, you know, Hindus and Muslims, because of the idea of trying to separate us and Muslims. And but I think when people ask why they have it now, and obviously the specific circumstances we can discuss about Quebec, but it's no coincidence that it's happening in other places too. You know, there's like famine in Iraq and Switzerland, Belgium, France, you know, you go through the list, and Britain, the UKIP party, which is a racist organisation, which is part of their, they're doing the general election, Van Burka. I mean, there are a handful of Muslims raised in Van Burka, but they got a million votes. You know, this is something that's going away. If we let it happen, if we don't confront it, it's something that's actually going to get more. And I think increased. And I think one of the things about why young women might choose to do now is about, well, if your religion and your whole identity is under attack, well, you're going to say, it's not you. I'm Muslim, I'm proud of it. And I'm going to show people I'm Muslim. I'm not wearing a hijab in the street. And I'm going to say, you're not going to put me down. And I think the developments here in Ireland, where I'm originally from, you know, were part of British imperialism, tried to drive the Catholic Church out and tried to make people pay tithes to the Protestant churches. So they have these huge red Protestant churches in Catholic areas, whereas the Catholics actually continue to practice their religion in hedge churches, on beaches. And actually, the Catholic religion is now much stronger in Ireland than many other countries, precisely because it's seen as part of the anti-imperialist struggle. And I think a similar thing is happening with Muslims. And my final point is, in Britain, we've talked about multiculturalism for many years. But, you know, having a wonderful multicultural difference in France, you know, people are allowed to have their other cultures and they're all British as well. But now it's changing. They're saying Muslims should integrate. You know, they're saying you should integrate in our great culture. What our culture? Some people say, what our culture? Fish and chips. You know, that's the great, you know. But also, I think it comes to women's oppression. The idea that there should be saying these women should integrate in our liberation. I mean, we talked about in a meeting yesterday, some, you know, about the idea of what is so great about women in Western society. You know, pumping a breast in a silicone to fit a certain model of what women should look like, etc., etc., because our religion. We haven't really got some great culture that we're trying to be like, and I think the contradiction of actually banning women coming out who might want to wear the burqa or the niqab or anything else means actually those women will be a far less chance of being a fasting, because actually precisely if they're not allowed to wear and get public services wearing a niqab, they will be at home. And therefore the contradiction is you're actually isolating people even more. And I think it's sort of really the only really African principle is to actually not align it to be seen as some sort of respectable racism, which actually people in Britain, people make totally racist comments about Muslims, but if you had an expression of Jewish or black in there instead of Muslim, it would be utterly unacceptable and you think it's never allowed to be on the television again. But actually it's become something that's respectable because of this idea of Islam being uniquely backward in some way. And I think it's a principle of socialism to stand against it and actually stop it increasing.
Thank you for that excellent discussion and for your questions. The panelists will now have an opportunity to come back on your questions for this session and wrap up a little bit, but please feel free to continue these conversations throughout the rest of the conference. After this session is lunch, then there are two more sessions in the afternoon, followed by a session in the evening on from Greece to the G20, and after that we're having a social event with a theater performance. So stick around for the rest of the day. Thank you.
you want to go in the same order?
Reverse order, same order. Doesn't matter.
Okay, I guess I can start off. I think that I kind of want to respond to some of the comments about the reaction of the Muslim community to a lot of these things. And I was having a conversation with some of my friends, we were driving up somewhere and we were talking about the niqab ban and how we are seeing so many women in Toronto and even on this campus where I work who are now wearing the niqab, just walking around going to school. And it's not something that, you know, even 2-3 years ago we were seeing. And it definitely is a response to what is happening in the repression. And people are saying, well, you're not going to let me do it, so I'm going to do it and show you that I can participate in society. And it's becoming more of a political statement necessarily than it is a religious statement. And I think that although for a lot of women who wear the hijab or wear the niqab, that is an expression of their faith, it's also an expression and a form of resistance to what is happening within Canada, within France, within Quebec, and all over the world, which in my mind, I don't necessarily think it's a new phenomenon. Immigrant communities have been under attack since the creation of Canada. Minority groups have been under attack since the creation of Canada and many of Western states, and have been used as an excuse really to wage war and because of the creation of imperialism and all of those things. So I just think that has been really the response amongst the Muslim community. I don't think that we have had time because of the attack to actually have an actual critical discussion about capitalism, about imperialism, about our roles within these societies. But I think women in general are starting to take on the hijab as a form of resistance and also start to question what it means to be a feminist and to work, to grow up in a society and to want equal rights and to want to access education and to want to access the workforce. And to be left alone, essentially, and be a Muslim at the same time, and what it means to have a feminist reading of the Quran, what it means to have a feminist reading of Islam, and what it actually means to take back Islam from our communities, but also from the West that has decided to label us. So I think that there is this move to define what is Canadianness, to define what it is to be British, to define what it is to be French, and define a nationality and protect that nationality and those values. And in the process, is an attack on the rights of all minority groups. And I think that right now it's just Islam is under attack because it's convenient and because we're waging wars against so-called Muslim countries.
First I'm going to address a couple of the comments and then bring up the what to do part that I didn't have time to do earlier. For sure there's an influence being felt in Quebec from debates happening in France. Usually, just because of the language, you know, it's easily accessible, and there's those historic ties. And more broadly, with what's going on in Europe. And for example, in the argument that are currently happening around how to define our own version of secularism, the people who want to ban all religious symbols from being worn by public servants, for example, would argue, well, see, in the European courts have ruled that banning those things from public servants is not against human rights, but it's fine, you know? So if European courts say it's fine, then, you know, why should we agree with Quebec courts or Canadian courts that go in the opposite direction? So they're saying it's not a human rights issue, basically. Like, they don't want to say we're against human rights. They want to say it's not a human rights issue. It's a secularism issue, you know, the way that they define secularism. But there's also a very strong influence of parts of the left coming from North Africa. In recent years in Quebec, there's been a lot of immigration coming from Morocco, Algeria, Tunisia, and among them, some people have tried to transpose the political struggles they're having in their own countries in their you know, new country, in their country of adoption. And one of these people, Ms. Ben Habib, has published a book called Ma vie à contre-courant, which is a silly pun about going against the current and against the Quran. Anyway, it sounds the same. And she's from Algeria, and she's been, since she published that book, she's been touring all over Quebec constantly as a, you know, speaker. And what she's telling people is, see what's happened in Algeria with the civil war and how those nasty, you know, Islamic fundamentalists, what they have done to women in Algeria, and that's why I'm here now. And if you want to help me in my fight against these nasty Muslims, then you have to ban religious symbols from your own society. You have to isolate those fundamentalists by not allowing them to basically show themselves or and all of that. So it's that notion that, you know, to free women over there, we should oppress women here. You know, it's that logic I was talking about earlier. But because it comes from a woman who was born in Algeria, it has a very strong appeal, a strong credibility. It has the aura of international solidarity, you know, which is something that everybody on the left in Quebec is very sensitive to. And I'll be honest with you, I haven't had the heart, the stomach to read her book. I have to do it probably this summer because somebody has to read that book critically and do something about it. This leads me to my what to do part. Six things. And unfortunately, I think I'm going to have to do all six of them over the next couple of years. First one, on the theoretical front, to provide an alternative analysis of what religion is, you know, and can be, you know, an alternative to the current philosophical trend, you know, which is religion is all bad, and we should be against all religions and anything that has to do with religion. The second thing is to build on the Quebec tradition of defending human rights. You know, there's an organization in Quebec that actually submitted a brief against Bill 94 for the right reasons, and it's called La Ligue des Droits de Liberté, and I'm going to join that group as soon as I get out of here, because we have to build that Quebec tradition of human rights, which has been undermined by the Trudeau legacy, by the fact that a lot of people in Quebec associate human rights with the unilateral patriation of the Constitution in 82 and Trudeau and the War Measures Act and all those other things, and go, no, we don't want the Canadian version of human rights and multiculturalism. Those are things being used against us. You know? And so we have to build that Quebec tradition of human rights. Then, obviously, educate people about the diversity within Islam and the Muslim world and, you know, Muslim people, but there's all kinds of ways of being Muslim, and within that, the most important thing is get people to listen to the voices of Muslim women, what they have to say about themselves and the choices they make, and instead of carrying all those assumptions préjugé. I don't remember how to say that in English. Okay, same thing. I thought I meant something else in English. Anyway, we also have to reorient the fight for secularism in Quebec, which is a relevant fight because of that Catholic legacy. You know, we have to reorient it towards the right target, which is, for example, right now in Quebec, about 40% of high school students go to private high schools, and most of those are religious high schools, and they're being subsidized by the government for at least 60% of their funding. Like, we're giving millions and millions and millions of dollars to Catholic institutions. And then, you know, somehow the problem of secularism in Quebec is like 10 women wearing niqab in Montreal. I mean, so we have to direct things in the right on the right target. Same thing for the national struggle in Quebec. I mean, Muslims coming from North Africa are not an issue for Quebec as a nation within Canada. Actually, a lot where our immigration policy is focusing on getting a lot of people from North Africa to come to Quebec because they already speak French. And they integrate wonderfully in the workplace, and, you know, and it's all good. The problem for the French language and for Quebec right now is globalization. It's the fact that globalization is forcing Quebec workers to work in English, even those who are, you know, like my sister and her partner. They live in the suburbs of Montreal, they go work in downtown Montreal, and they have to be bilingual or they wouldn't have those jobs. And lastly, as was mentioned, we need to build working class solidarity beyond all cultural or religious or other differences. As Chantal pointed out, there's that, you know, potential huge struggle in the public sector in Quebec happening right now. And a big inspiration for me in that entire discussion has been one of my coworkers, who is a Muslim woman wearing a hijab, who's from Morocco. And she's a very good teacher. Nobody has any complaints about how she teaches, and the fact that she wears a hijab doesn't prevent her from being a really good teacher. And for me, that's the criteria, you know. If something is going to discriminate against her, you know, be unfair to her, it's bad, you know, and that's it. And most of the workers in my workplace agree with that. And there's going to be a debate over the next year or so in my union federation about secularism and how we should define it as teachers and how, what our view of a secular school and all of that. And I'm going to engage in those debates, and you know, with all the good ideas that everybody in this room has to contribute. And I'm reasonably hopeful that the union movement in Quebec is going to start shifting away from that kind of rhetoric and those positions, because a lot of unions support banning religious symbols and all of that, which is, in my view, appalling. You know, it's unions campaigning to remove rights, you know, of their own members, you know, against the rights of their own members. And that has to change. But I think it can happen, and those are the next steps. Thanks.
I think there were some really good questions raised and a very good discussion that already took place. So I will try to answer some of the questions and maybe hopefully add a few points here. On the question of why now, I think we may want to ask this for different groups and different constituencies. Why now in terms of why have certain forms of dress, why have headscarves or the niqab and so on been more common and more popular among Muslims? I agree with Gilly in the sense that yes, it has something to do with the reaction towards the exclusion, the rejection, the racism and culturalist racism and so on directed against Muslims. Some observers have actually pointed out that among people whose mothers and grandmothers have never worn the headscarf, young women started embracing it in the diaspora right after the first Gulf War, 1991. So it has something directly to do with this environment of perceived war against Muslims and the attack on Muslims and so on. And that's something we need to think about. If we want to think about questions of when certain choices might be made and why certain choices might be made. On the same question of why now, culturalization of political issues and political divisions and so on. Why is Islam versus secularism and so on becoming a very important issue? I think many of us would agree that those in the right have a stake in fueling these kinds of divisions and these kinds of debates and appealing to the increased insecurity on the part of the larger population of people, so socially, economically, and so on. And it's also very important, as some people have already pointed out here, to sabotage a potential solidarity among people against neoliberal policies and so on. In terms of why people in the left are buying into this, I just want to point out that this increased interest of people in the left for an interventionist kind of politics internationally in the name of human rights. I mean, think about humanitarian interventions and the right to protect and so on. This stronger urge on the part of the people, left liberals and other leftists, to save the others. It doesn't have to do with equality and justice having been accomplished here. On the contrary, as David Harvey and others have pointed out, I would actually argue that it is a sign of the sense of desperation about the chances of social struggles here for equality and justice that is urging some people to direct their energies elsewhere and to try to save the other instead of trying to save themselves, because they've given up on any chances of saving themselves. So I think there's a need on those in the left to perhaps question what is happening here about this supposed interest in the destiny of the others. Why not change what needs to be changed here, and why direct all the energies either elsewhere internationally or on the others defined as others in this society. So it does say something about the general state of democracy and the general state of or the possibility of social change here. I just another point I want to make is about the question of what we may need to be wary of or what we may need to avoid in terms of the framing of these debates in Western societies and what it could do in the Muslim diaspora here. I'm afraid that the framing of the debate, as I have already said during my talk, I am afraid that the framing of the debate as around issues of secularism versus Islam and so on may actually may create further splits among Muslims here. It may, on the one hand, create increased conservatism among some Muslims, and it may also lead to a perspective on the part of some Muslims against secularism as the enemy or the secular Muslims. I mean, that sounds like a contradiction, but those people with a Muslim background who may be secular themselves as the enemy, as the target that they may also need to fight against. And that would be a dangerous fight or a dangerous kind of division that might occur that we need to be aware of. I think that those Muslims who may practice Islam more actively may try to be cautious about seeing those people who are secular as the sellouts, as the collaborationists, and so on. As I was mentioning in relation to these books by Vali Nasser, it seems like secularism is being defined now, secularism in Muslim majority societies is being defined in foreign policy circles as a foreign kind of influence, as a form of alienation from an essence of those societies being essentially Muslim and Muslim period. I think that that's a very simplistic approach to what secularism has been in some societies, because it has in Turkey, for example, 80 plus years of influence, it has gone beyond being just an elitist imposition on the rest of society. It has become something that has been embraced in different ways or at different levels but by different people in the larger society, and therefore it has a presence that cannot be ignored. So, as well in the diaspora, I think there are all sorts of people whose approach to Islam may differ significantly from one another, and we need to be very open to the diversity of those identities and of those political positions instead of seeing each other potentially as enemies and as the targets and so on. Thank you.
Thank you, everyone. Have a good lunch.
Very nice. Mm-hmm. I like